Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to call the committee to order. Quorum is present, and we have a lot of business to do today. So we'd like to, first of all, do a minute. Okay, we have some minutes that need approval. We have minutes from February 28th, February March 4th, and March 5th. Representative Benson moves approval of the minutes from February 28th, March 4th, and March 5th.
Madam Chair, I've read them all, and I believe they're all accurate.
Wonderful. Thank you, Representative Benson. Any comments on the minutes? All right. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Minutes are approved. Thank you. Okay. House File 2446, Representative Simonson. Welcome to the committee.
Thank
you,
Madam Chair.
And I'm going to move Representative Simonson's bill, so I'll move that House File 2446 be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary. And I understand there's an A2 amendment here. And I will, is that to be put on the bill right now, Representative Simonson?
Yes, Madam Chair, that amendment would get it in the shape that I'd like to see it in.
All right, so the A2 amendment is before you, members, and so I would move the A2 amendment. Any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Motion prevails. And we have the bill in the shape the author would like to discuss it. And go ahead, Representative Simonson.
Madam Chair, in the interest of preserving your time and the time of the committee, do I understand correctly you've heard the pharmacy bill, your House File 2545, already?
Correct. And it all was heard this morning in civil law as well.
Madam Chair, many of the provisions in my bill that would be applicable to this committee are contained in that same agency bill. I'd be more than happy to walk through this section by section if you like, but if you would rather not repeat some of those things, that would be fine too.
Okay, and Representative Simonson, I think it would be worth a little bit of review for members. We've heard a lot of bills already this session, and I'm not sure members, I know members are really, really busy, and
sure.
So this might be, if you could just kind of remind us, and I know this is also coming out of a lot of work that you did in the interim, so I think it's fair to give you a chance to let us know a little bit about that work, since this is the Health Committee, and update us a bit and tell us what the bill is doing.
Of course, Madam Chair, and I'll do that, and I'll do that as quickly as I can. I want to thank you for this hearing, Madam Chair, as well as your participation in a joint hearing over the interim. For those members that don't remember or don't realize, the Speaker at the end of last session established a select committee to look at the issue of synthetic drugs and controlled substances across the state. And that committee creation was done in response to a bill that I introduced last session dealing with synthetic drugs. And being from Duluth, the issue of synthetic drugs is near and dear to my heart. I think that one of the things that the select committee learned as we traveled across the state is that synthetic drugs are prevalent in all of our communities. Just happens to be that much of the media attention was focused on Duluth and in a retail shop there. But this effort on the next step, if you will, in combating synthetic drugs in our communities is going to be part of a continued effort. There's certainly no reason to believe that we won't have to come back and revisit this issue in the future, as we have to adjust to ever-changing products that are available on the illegal drug market. This particular bill in front of you has been a very collaborative effort. The House has been very involved in this. Members of both caucuses, staff, Attorney General's office was heavily involved in this issue. We participated in a joint hearing with her. Many agencies, state and local. But I think most importantly, members of our select committee would tell you that the most important testimony that we heard was testimony from individuals, victims, and members of their families. We heard some pretty powerful and compelling testimony that caused us to believe that this is a serious problem and requires some outside-the-box thinking. Synthetic cannabinoids and synthetic cathinones continue to be a problem, especially amongst our student populations and young adults, and that's really the target audience that we want to focus on going forward. So what you see in this bill before you is essentially the recommendations of the Select Committee, and I think I understand that the report was handed out as part of your packet. Is that correct, Madam Chair? If not, we want to get that to you later.
I don't think so. Really.
Okay, there is a report from the Select Committee that was presented to the Speaker, and if you don't have that, we'll make sure that that gets to you in the future.
That would be helpful, thank you.
Because it's got some really good information on it. I'm going to limit my testimony today to myself and Mr. Cody Weiberg, if he happens to get here before I end, but I'm sure that you've already heard from him about his testimony, and it's probably very similar. But I'm just going to walk briefly through the bill and explain a little bit about some of the individual sections. Section 1 essentially expands the current definition of drug in statute. And what we're attempting to do here is to capture the synthetic drugs that we've been talking about without targeting legal products that are already on the market. And we're focusing on drugs that are not regulated by the U.S. FDA and, the key word being and, that when induced, they have to produce an effect similar to current scheduled drugs. And this is where we get into the need for expert testimony when we talk about prosecution of these particular cases. Section 2 provides the Board of Pharmacy the authority to issue cease and desist orders for violating this law. And this really is one of the hearts of this bill. And I'll just give you an example that might help you wrap your head around it. In Duluth, we had a retail shop that was selling synthetic drugs for a number of months, actually years, while the process worked itself out through the courts. And just to give you a scope of what that means, that in 1 year, 12 calendar months' time, there was $6 million gross sales of synthetic drugs out of this one retail shop downtown Duluth. Significant amount. Had this provision been in place, when this all started, we could have, local authorities could have called upon the Board of Pharmacy to come in, collect a sample. BCA could have processed it if it was found out that it could have been legal or it was illegal. Not only would we continue down the legal path, but the Board of Pharmacy would have had the authority to issue a cease and desist on the sale of that particular product. And it's important to realize that the cease and desist is specific to that particular product, only not necessarily closing down the retail establishment. So we think that that would have saved us many months of sales of these products and kept a fair amount of people out of the emergency rooms and saved a lot of destructions on individual lives and families. Section 2 goes on to provide the same notice and hearing rights as current law. And Section 3 covers the enforcement of cease and desist and injunction relief provision. Section 4 addresses the exception portion of current law when we talk about things such as paint and glues and things like that. We're not certainly targeting things that are currently legal under current law. Section 5 brings in the same language to the list of prohibited acts. Section 6 deems a drug adulterated. Under definition, that is manufactured at an unlicensed facility. And Section 7 would change the term identity to ingredients under definition of misbranded drugs. And Section 8 deals with the Board of Pharmacy and the expedited scheduling that was put in by prior legislation. This removes the requirement for legislative ratification when the board, by their rulemaking process, adds a substance to Schedule 1 during a time when the legislature is not in session. This legislature going forward, if this were signed into law, would always continue to retain the authority to make changes in statute as they saw fit. But this provision would require that legislative ratification. Section 9, 10, and 12 we have just deleted with the amendment that was adopted. And Section 11 is the only money piece that's really left in this bill, and it deals with the Department of Education and a educational effort that will be targeting middle school, high school, and college-age kids, trying to educate them about synthetic drugs and the hazards of those drugs, and a good educational effort in conjunction with current drug awareness. So that, Madam Chair, is essentially a summary of the bill. Cody Weiberg is here as well to answer any questions of the committee, and with that, I would stand for questions.
All right. Thank you very much, Representative Simonson. Are there any questions from members of the committee? I'm not seeing any, and I know Dr. Weiberg was with me and testified this morning in civil law on the Board of Pharmacy bill, which contains most of these provisions, not all of them. There are pieces that don't pertain to that bill, but I just had asked him this morning a question about it, and I think I'll just ask him to explain it for all of you, and that is on page 7, the deletion of all of this language about reporting to the chairs and minority ranking minority members of the House and Senate committees. And just, Dr. Weiberg, if you would just tell the committee, as you told me this morning, why we're removing that language, because it looks at first glance like, oh, we're not going to find out something, but that's not the case. Dr. Weiberg.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dr. Cody Weiberg, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Pharmacy, and the reason that that language is not necessary is the rulemaking procedures in this state that are found in Chapter 14 in the rules they're under about rulemaking already require an agency that's engaging in rulemaking to notify the, I believe it's the chairs and the ranking minority members of each of the relevant committees. So there's already a requirement that we would have to report back to the committees. We've done that with all the rulemaking that we've done.
Okay, thank you very much. Any other questions for members? All right, not seeing any, and I just want to thank Representative Simonson for all of your work on this. I mean, I think this, for members who attended that joint hearing we had in the interim, the impact of these substances is just devastating. These are horrible drugs, and this is great work to try to keep this away from Minnesotans. Representative Simonson, I think the state really owes you a debt of gratitude. I hope we can get this passed and into law, and you know, we're going to have to continue our work on these things, but this is very, very serious and urgent stuff. So thank you very much. So, and so I'm going to renew my motion to, let's see here. Okay. I'm going to renew my motion that House File 2446 be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee.
Prevails. Thank you, sir. Representative Lane, 2330. I'm sorry, 2320. Welcome to the committee, Representative Lane. And Representative Lane, I will move that House File 2320 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. And there is an author's amendment here, I understand.
Yes, the A1 amendment. The amendment just adds Minnesota Hospital Association to the list of organizations in the bill.
All right. And so I will move the A1 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Motion prevails. And Representative Lane has the bill in the order in which she'd like to discuss it. And,
thank you, Madam Chair. This bill relates to the Civil Commitment Act, and we have all 87 of our counties using the Civil Commitment Act, but many different people in those counties apply it. Judges, county attorneys, public defenders, social workers, peace officers, hospital staff, and more. So there's many varying interpretations that take place. We want to be sure that people whose symptoms require the use of the Commitment Act obtain the treatment they need, and we want to make sure that people who don't meet the criteria are not committed. There is the Office of the Ombudsman of Mental Health that works to conduct trainings around the state. However, they just don't have enough staff to do all the training that's necessary. So what we think in this bill is that it makes sense to create an online training program for anyone who wants to learn more about it, including family members and individuals who live with mental illness. And this bill then brings together the very people who have to implement it to make sure they have agreed upon the interpretation and make sure that the training that's developed covers all the topics that are most likely to raise questions or be misinterpreted. It appropriates $335,000 from the general fund to the Department of Human Services to put this together.
All right. Thank you, Representative Lane. And you have Sue Abderholden. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. And I just want to say that we get, obviously, a lot of calls into the NAMI office about people who are either trying to get their loved ones committed, but we also get calls from people who are in the hospital committed who don't think that they need to be there. We actually developed a booklet called Understanding the Minnesota Civil Commitment Process because when I first came to NAMI 12 years ago, it was the number one phone call that we got. If you think about it in terms of all of the 87 different counties, for some of the counties, you might only have a handful of people who are committed every year. And so people aren't really very clear on what this process is. I think it's important both ways, that where people should be committed, that they are, and where people who shouldn't be, aren't. And just to bring some clarification to this, I think makes sense. NAMI's actually developed a couple of online training programs for other things, and we've come in way under $35,000, so we think that it can be done for that amount of money. And I really urge your support. I think it's an important issue to make sure everyone's really clear on how this act is supposed to be used.
Thank you, Ms. Abderholden. Our questions for members? All right. Not seeing any. Thank you very much. Is there anyone in the audience who wants to testify for or against the bill? All right. Not seeing any takers. So I think we're ready to vote. Thank you very much. Okay. So let's see. So I'm going to renew my motion that House File 2320, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative
Thank
Lane.
You. Thank
Ms.
you.
Abderholden.
Thank you.
Okay. Is Representative Dorhold here? Okay, I think he had another bill up in another committee. So I think we could go to Representative Loeffler. She's ready. And that would be House File 2169.
That's correct. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I'd like to move House File 2169 to bring it before the committee, and I have a small amendment that I'd like to add to get the bill to final order. It's an A1 amendment.
Okay, that would be great, Representative Loeffler. So Representative Loeffler has moved House File 2169 to bring it before the committee, but members, this bill will be laid over for possible inclusion in the policy omnibus bill. So we're just moving it so that it can be amended. And then Representative Loeffler moves the A1 amendment.
That's correct.
So, Representative Loeffler, do you need to explain anything about the A1? We're just to put it in the form in which you want it discussed,
correct?
Yeah,
it just clarifies some of the language.
All right. Any questions to the amendment? Okay. Seeing none, all in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Motion prevails. And go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Back in 2012, we made, I think, an important change to the adult foster care system to create a mental health certification program so that people would know which corporate foster care homes had staffing in mental illnesses and access to at least a mental health practitioner. Before that, it wasn't always really clear where to refer someone to, and this made sure that we had some specialized homes available. As this was being implemented, some problems came to light related to the training, who should provide it, how to really make that requirement work. And so a work group was combined by Department of Human Services this fall. It included county staff, providers, and advocates. And they discussed a wide range of topics, including trainer qualifications, trainer competency measures, what the content area should include, when and how often direct care staff should receive training, and similar issues. And this bill, it was brought to me by NAMI to reflect many of the consensus decisions within that group. And what the bill does is it clarifies that this section is for homes that serve people whose primary diagnosis is mental illness. We know that many people with other challenges in their life may at times suffer from some mental health challenges, but their primary diagnosis is what makes the difference here. We add training on suicide warning signs and interventions, since that is a high risk for this population. And as a result, we also require that there be a crisis plan in place, so if something arises, we know how the staff there knows how to handle it for that particular person. It tightens up who can give the training. It must be a mental health professional or practitioner, or it can be a person who lives with mental health or family members if they are approved by DHS to deliver the training. And it clarifies what components of the training people must have before they actually start working with clients. And, you know, there may need to be some minor tweaking of the language before we roll it into the omnibus bill. The Department of Human Services just 5 minutes ago said, oh, we'd like to clarify a couple words, and we'll work on that. But the intention is still the same. It's just interpretation of the order.
Okay.
And I have with me Sue Abderholden from the National Alliance for Mental Ill.
Okay, we haven't seen her since 5 minutes ago.
I'm just glad, Madam Chair, that her voice is holding out with this many bills.
Yes, welcome back to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Sue Abderholden with NAMI. Just a reminder that before we had this in place, we really had many, many problems with some corporate foster care, not all, but with some. We had situations where people really had no idea how to deal with a mental health crisis. They would call the police. People would get, you know, carted off to jail because someone didn't know how to use de-escalation techniques. So that was really important that we do this. I want to point out that this is a voluntary certification. You don't have to do it, even if you are serving with people with mental illness. This is just if you want to do it, so you can kind of hang a little certificate on your wall to say, yes, our staff has this training, and yes, we have these mental health professionals or practitioners available to people. When we looked at who should do the training, knowing that these types of homes, if they want the certificate, have to have a mental health professional or practitioner already available, which is basically meaning on their staff, that would make it easy for them to actually teach the training, so that would be helpful. They don't have to, you know, hire someone new. They already have to have them available. The second thing, in terms of people who live with a mental illness or family members, it really is groups like NAMI and the Mental Health Association, where we do a lot of training for professionals and for family members. My staff, either pretty much all of them, either live with a mental illness or have a family member. They go through a lot of training. Some of them have taken the 40-hour training from the National Council of Behavioral Health to actually teach mental health first aid. You know, and if you didn't have that in there, I wouldn't be able to teach on mental illness, and I would probably be pretty good at that and probably know more than a lot of other folks on that. So we want to make sure. But then we said the department would have to really make sure that organization could do that, so you don't have a fly-by-night organization coming in and saying, oh, yeah, we have a person with a mental illness who will go out and do that training. So that was kind of our quality loop, if you will, in there to make sure that didn't happen. And then lastly, when all of us were talking, we realized that before anyone starts working in these homes, and you have to remember that most of the people, actually a large percentage of the people from Minooka, get discharged to a corporate foster care home. Before you even start, you need to know crisis de-escalation techniques. It makes such a difference. You can talk to police officers who've learned de-escalation techniques as well, and they will tell you it is night and day when you learn what those techniques are. You know, don't touch someone, speak softly, you know, don't look them in the eyes, you know, all sorts of things like that you can really totally resolve a problem and not have someone end up going to the jail or into an emergency room. So I think these are really good additions to the bill that you passed, the law that you passed. We just want, again, if we're going to have a lot of folks in these homes, we want to know that they have the staff who are trained properly and that we do the right thing by people.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Abderholden. Questions from members? Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I know that you're not modifying this section, but I just was wondering if you could speak to on line 1.17 of the bill. It says all staff, and I appreciate that everyone within an organization should require you know have an awareness. But I'm just wondering if that's if there's any rationale for direct patient support staff as opposed to the folks that are doing the accounts receivable or the receptionist. If there's any differentiation between who is realizing the training as opposed to who obviously would benefit but from a cost standpoint may not realize a need for it per se.
Ms. Abderholden.
Madam Chair, Representative, if you note that it also says working in the adult foster care home, and we've not had any problems with that yet, but that's why we put the word in there.
Okay. I have just one more, Madam Chair.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the testifier on line 2.10, could you just help me understand what it means by, say, individual that identifies?
Oh, Madam Chair.
Ms. Abderholden.
So what we wanted to make sure is that for each individual who is in a corporate foster home, again, just the ones who want the certification, that there's a crisis plan. And the crisis plan would include who's providing the clinical services. So, for example, a crisis plan, you know, say if it was on me, we're in a corporate foster home, you would want to know who my psychiatrist is. So that you can call them if there's a crisis. So it really is just making sure you have that basic information so that in case of a crisis, you know who to call.
Thank you.
Right. Representative Albright, I think I see here that it is a little confusing with the cross out and so on to see what the sentence actually says, and maybe that's where you were going with that.
Thank you.
Okay. Other questions, members? All right, not seeing any. So is there anyone in the audience who wants to testify for or against the bill? Welcome. Please come up. Welcome to the committee, and just give us your name.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Barb Turner, and I'm with ARM. And we are we represent providers who do adult foster care services, some of whom provide services to people whose primary diagnosis is mental illness. And we weren't involved in this work group, so our concerns come now after seeing the bill. There are things that we like about it. One of the things that causes us some concern is the requirement for training to be done by a mental health practitioner or mental health professional. Even though a person may be on staff of an organization, with 7 hours of training per person required with staff turnover, it can be very expensive to use that professional to do that training. Our thought is that with an approved curriculum, there should be other trainers who could do the training with an approved curriculum, which would be very similar to how medication administration training is currently held for folks. There has to be an approved curriculum, but then anyone can train it, and it doesn't have to be a nurse. A nurse or a medical professional has to develop the curriculum, but not necessarily provide the training. This bill also allows a person with mental illness or a family member with a person of mental illness to provide the training. And our concern is, got some clarification just before this, but our concern is that it specifically talks about nonprofit providers, and we're not quite understanding why there would be a preference for a nonprofit over a for-profit organization if they were able to provide the training and be approved by the commissioner. And then we really like the clarification that 3 of the 7 hours need to be provided prior to the employee working alone. We think that's important. And we're just hoping that possibly there could be some better clarification on whether the requirement for this 7 hours of training is in addition to the 30 hours of orientation currently required under 245D, or if it is intended to be part of. And so it's been interpreted both ways, and that ends up being, it's been dependent on the counties, how counties have interpreted it. So we like there to be some clarification, if possible, in this bill.
All right. Representative Loeffler, do you want to respond to any of those things?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And you know, I know it's tough when we have advisor groups and not everybody's at the table, and so you kind of react to the language when you haven't heard the discussion. And I know that in the time before we put up the full bill, we'll be glad to make sure that you get brought up to speed and get a copy of what the working group recommendations are. And I think the suggestion to just clarify the hours issue is one of the suggestions that we will put into the language. But with that, I'd ask, you know, Ms. Abderholden if she would like to respond, because I, too, was not part of the stakeholder group, and some of these issues, I suspect, were brought up there.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. Ms. Abderholden, if you would want to respond. And then just a reminder, this bill will be laid over for possible inclusion in the policy omnibus bill, so there is a little time to work out any little kinks in the language. Ms. Abderholden?
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, my problem was saying that someone can go to a seven-hour training, and we've actually provided the training twice to foster care parents, and then go back and teach everyone else. I don't think you know a lot after 7 hours. I mean, I hate to say that, but you don't. And when we've done the training, we get a lot of questions from people about, well, so what does it mean if someone has schizophrenia and they do this, and what does it mean for that? And I think that your bandwidth in terms of knowledge is after 7 hours isn't enough, frankly, to teach someone else. And we are talking about people who are just having mild depression. We're talking many people who are leaving Anoka, who are then coming to these corporate foster homes, and frankly, you better know a little bit more than that. And so that's why we really felt like, again, the foster homes have to have, you know, available these mental health professionals or practitioners who can do the training. You know, we could probably develop an online training at some point, but the question and answer part is huge in any of the trainings that we do, and you want to have someone who knows something.
Okay, Representative Abler.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I think you're doing the right thing with it. It's nice this is being laid over. But I just listened to Ms. Turner and Ms. Abderholden and the author. I think the topic is really important. I think it's important to move forward with something that requires training. But I hope that the providers are listened to in the next week in a way that's meaningful. These providers have been squeezed in terms of how thin their ranks are. There are no hours just laying around, and there's no really pots of money that they have left. And so it has to be practical, and you actually want them to do it and not just not do it and then wait for a fine to happen. And so I think that all the three individuals there know each other, and they know how to figure something out, and I hope that there can be a healthy dialogue in the next 10 days.
Okay. Thanks, Representative Abler. Ms. Afterholden, you want to
Madam Chair, if I could, Representative Abler, the one thing, just remember, this is voluntary. But this is not a requirement, even if you serve people with a serious mental illness. It's just that if you want to create the certification. We did have providers at the table who were fine with this.
Okay, thanks for that clarification. Okay, I'm not seeing any other questions. Is there anybody else in the audience who wants to testify for or against the bill? All right, not seeing anybody there. Representative Loeffler, do you want to finalize this, say anything more?
No, I'll just say that I think it's important to have we talked earlier about the need to have a step-down system where people who are discharged out of our most intensive services like Anoka Regional Treatment Center, they're going to have to go to a place where we have people who are really trained enough so they don't just bounce right back. Or, unfortunately, some of them end up in emergency rooms or jails, which are very expensive places and not good places to heal. And so, you know, this is just helping us build that system so that we can have some stability in these lives.
All right. Thank you, Representative Loeffler and Ms. Afterholden, and also Ms. Turner. So House File 2169 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Okay, Representative Dorholt is still not in the room, so we'll go to Representative Moran's bill, which is, let's see, which is House File 2361. Okay, and so Representative Moran moves that House File 2361 be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations, and there are two amendments in the packet, but I think that we will first ask Representative Moran to go ahead and present her bill, and then we'll deal with the amendments after she's had an opportunity to do that. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I would like to move House File 2361.
Okay, go ahead.
So, Madam Chair and members, Minnesota has a long history of being a leader and trailblazer in the world of health care. Minnesota has been innovative and provides some of the best services. Minnesota does well on statewide averages for the health of people in our state and our quality of care. But the health disparities of communities of color are among the most extreme in the nation. This is a great concern to me. The Department of Health, in their 2011 report, noted that one of the challenges related to developing and evaluating programs to address and eliminate health disparities is the relative lack of data. In the Minnesota Department of Health report, they stated, It is important for all of these stakeholders, organizations, to develop and nurture strong relationships with communities of color in order to ensure that their activities are addressing the true causes of disparities. MDH released a much-discussed February report that found persistent health disparities in minority communities. The report found that low-income and people of color have less opportunities for health and experience the worst health outcomes in Minnesota. In bold language, the Minnesota Department of Health report blamed structural racism embedded in Minnesota institutions, policies, and procedures as the reason for the significant racial inequalities in health outcomes, and recommended an overhaul of the state approach to health. I know and believe that this is not the intent of the state, but this is the reality that is impacting real people's lives, fathers, mothers, and children of color. So today, the Council of Black Minnesotans is present to present some solutions to help the state in bringing better outcomes to communities of color so that we can work towards reducing disparities that are embedded in our health care system. So with that, I would like to pass the mic on to my first testifier.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, and other esteemed representatives of the House Committee on Human and Health and Human Services Policy, Representative Moran, my name is Yende Anderson, and I'm grateful for the opportunity to speak to you today concerning House File 2361. As Representative Moran stated, Minnesota was consistently first or second in national health rankings, but in recent years, Minnesota has fallen as low as sixth. Reason for this include the health differences that exist in Minnesota between white populations and populations of color and American Indians. Minnesota has some of the worst income, employment, and health disparities in the country. Many of Minnesota's population of color and American Indians lack the same opportunities to be healthy because of factors such as economic instability, unsafe neighborhoods, and inadequate access to health care. These differences ultimately result in poorer health outcomes, shorter lifespans, higher health care costs, and low productivity. Minnesota's population of color and American Indians have grown from just over 6% of the total population in 1990 to almost 17% in 2012. The Eliminating Health Disparities Initiative was established by legislative mandate in 2001. Since that establishment, there has been no changes to the health priorities mandated by that legislation. The investment in EHDI in 2010 was approximately $5 per person, a relatively small amount compared to the $6,913 spent on health care per Minnesotan in 2009. In addition, the Association of American Medical Colleges estimates that the United States will face a shortage of more than 91,500 physicians by 2020. 45,000 of those doctors are in primary care. Minnesota is expected to be $2,000 short. Several factors have contributed to the problem, including an expected influx of newly insured patients under the Affordable Care Act and an aging population of doctors. One way to address this problem is to fully integrate foreign-trained medical doctors into the Minnesota healthcare system. Currently, there are over 240 foreign-trained medical doctors who are wanting and willing to help address the Minnesota physician shortage, but due to systemic issues, they are working as cab drivers and cashiers. Thankfully, the Minnesota legislature, recognizing this asset, has twice funded scholarships for these foreign healthcare professionals to study and prepare for exams. These funds have been very appreciated by the doctors and have allowed over 100 of them to prepare for the necessary exams. However, they face a roadblock when it comes to obtaining residency slots. Several of these doctors have passed exams with Minnesota support, but were faced to move to another state because they were not accepted into into residency programs in Minnesota. They want to live in Minnesota in both rural and urban areas and make contributions to their new home and their community. Integrating them into the system would address the physician shortage issue, but it would also address the disparity within the healthcare system by providing culturally and linguistically appropriated healthcare services. Therefore, I humbly urge your support of this bill. I'm confident that this bill will allow Minnesota to take a giant step in eradicating health disparities in health care. Thank you for your support on this issue.
Thank you very much, Ms. Anderson. Any questions from members on this? Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Anderson, your testimony, as you state, is really focused on encouraging the recruitment of physicians to some of these areas that are underserved. Would that be correct?
Ms. Anderson?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, yes, my testimony did focus on the doctors, but also on EHDI, having some of their priorities looked at so that because the statute was enacted in 2001, and those priorities have not been looked at, and now that we're in 2014, it's conceivable that some of the priorities that they established in 2001 would be different for communities of color in 2014. So we just like, one, the task force looking at the possible funding of the foreign trained medical doctors, and also a task force looking at how we can review those priorities to make sure we're actually addressing the needs of the community and we're addressing issues upstream before these diseases present.
Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm curious then if it would appear from your testimony and the answer you just provided that the issues are well known and presumably understood in terms of how to address from a standpoint of you need more assistance from a medical standpoint in those communities. I guess I have a two-part question. One is if the issues are already known, why would we need a task force in order to consider what is necessary? And my second part of the question is, why would we not entertain going straight to the point with some of the larger healthcare organizations and having them come alongside your constituency in addressing those issues as well?
Ms. Anderson.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, the issues are known, but I don't think recommendations have been agreed upon by all stakeholders, and I think that's where the task force would be useful. For example, today I have, there are about 11 doctors sitting in that section. You guys can stand if you like. They're all working with a nonprofit that has been trying to find how we can have an alternative funding for foreign trained medical doctors. They come from all over the world and speak different languages, but without bringing the stakeholders to the table and looking at different recommendations of public funding, public-private partnership, private endowment, we really don't know what is best in this environment, and I think that's where the task force would be helpful.
Mm-hmm. Representative Albright?
Thank you, Madam Chair. You speak of stakeholders to the conversation. Could you cite specific stakeholder organizations, entities that would be involved in these conversations?
Ms. Anderson.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, some of the stakeholders include people from the Department of Health, possibly DHS, nonprofit organizations serving foreign medical doctors like New American Alliance for Development. There's also a group working with the doctors in Rochester. And then, as you mentioned, the healthcare organizations in the state, as well as the clinics. There's also a task force that was established to look at the shortage of doctors, bringing some of those people to this task force because it's a different solution than what that task force presented. So bring some of them to look at this issue differently, to come up with recommendations that would really move Minnesota, not just in filling a shortage, but in providing access and opportunity to people who are not using the system the way it should be used, which is causing these outcomes.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the grant that you're requesting of $250,000, and I see that there's an amendment as well. But I'll just speak to
Representative Albright, that's not hers.
Is not? I'm sorry.
No.
So to the point of the grant itself, are you establishing a working task force that this outreach to the communities, what would the dollars be used for specifically?
Representative Albright, there's no appropriation in the bill. That's the amendment, and the amendment is not this testifier's amendment, so I think you might be asking the wrong person. If you look at the bill, there's no appropriation in the bill. And the amendments, there are amendments that have money in them, but they haven't been offered yet, Representative Albright.
I'll hold back on that question then, Madam Chair.
Okay, we've got two other members on the list. If you're finished, Representative
Albright. I am, thank you.
Okay, Representative Mack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think several from around the table are familiar with task forces and the issues that we're trying to get at a lot of times with this. And I know last year we heard a few, I can't remember right off the top of my head, but that we're trying to get at some of these same issues where we talked about health disparities is a common topic that we're always trying to address. And I guess one question in regards to the bill, and I don't know if this is for the author or the testifier, maybe both. A lot of times in task force legislation, we see some sort of prescribing factor that kind of gets at the goal of what the author's intent is, who you want to see on this. The way I see it, this is pretty much left wide open. What assurance do you have that you're going to get the kind of folks that you want to see on this task force? To me, that seems like a bit of a critical piece, that you have a good balance, maybe regionally, maybe diversity-wise, from the departments, members of the bodies. I don't know. I don't see many assurance that you're going to get what you're going for. There's not a whole lot of information. Is there a reason why that was left out in this particular instance for a task force?
Ms. Anderson? Or Representative Moran?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. One of the things that I've been in conversation with the Department of Health, and from that conversation that the Department of Health will be creating a Center for Health Equity. And just based on their report about the structural racism that is embedded in the policies, the programs, the services, and the systems and been implemented and not really fully be representative of what the needs are in the communities of color. I think in partnership, we would work towards who those parties would need to be as they deal with their reports.
And Representative Mack, the bill is going to government operations as well, and I'm sure that there'll be further discussion about the structure of the task force at that point.
Yeah. And Madam Chair, just
Representative Mack.
Just a brief follow-up. I think that's a good point, and I guess I would just maybe suggest that might be a good direction to go. And I guess just one concern, I know this is a big issue that needs to be addressed in the state, but I it's a common conversation, and even getting our brains around it at the table, there seems to a lot of times be a lot of different working groups, task forces, nonprofits working on this. I know Representative Halverson and I working on a task force that just deals with healthcare costs in general, but we had groups that came before that, nonprofits, dealing a lot with disparities, and sometimes it's hard as legislators and I'm sure in the community to get our head around who's doing what, who's accomplishing what, and is it all working towards a common goal, at least to a certain extent. And I think task forces are much more productive when the focus is clear and when you get the people in the room that can really get you going in the right direction. So I would hope to see that as this goes forward.
All right. Thank you, Representative Mack. Representative Franson, then Abler.
Thank you, Madam Speaker, or I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I too am concerned about the shortages that we are facing in the medical community with doctors, and unfortunately, I believe that the ACA is one of those unintended consequences. So that is something to think about as we go forward here.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Franson. It's true, when people have insurance, more people will be able to get to see a doctor, yep. One hopes. Mm-hmm. Representative Abler.
Thanks. I'll just move on to the next topic. Representative Moran and Ms. Anderson, I appreciate your effort to nudge the Department of Health, and I appreciate what they do there, but I think they absolutely need this effort to focus on certain disparity groups, and just the advice from Representative Mack might actually be friendly, where you want to at least mention that they have to, every significant subgroup has to be considered, and it's your bill, but this focus is essential. So good luck, and if I can help, let me know.
Yeah, Representative Paper. Again, you know, you are correct. There has been many different task force. So much like we have many departments where each department is doing what they do, and it's not intentional engagement, or we don't know what the others are doing. So my hope and our hope as we look at this bill and going forward, that we can work in partnership and collaboration with the center, with the Department of Health, in their work with the creation of the Center for Health Equity, so that it is really crucial that there are many players that are at the table, and that we're all working towards the common goal of ending disparities. We're talking about healthcare, but we can also just integrate that into all the other systems too.
All right, thank you, Representative Moran. I'm not seeing other questions from members. I think we could probably move on to the amendments, and then also we will give opportunity for people in the audience to testify for or against the bill, but let's first move on to the amendments. So the first one that we have is the A3, and that's actually my amendment, and so I'm going to move the A3 amendment. And members, last year, just as background for this, last year in our Health and Human Service Finance Bill, there was a bill carried last year by Representative Norton, and if you remember, we had a hearing in this committee on where Fartoon Welly, who was with a small organization in Minneapolis that does women's health with Somali women, was here, and there was a bill carried by Representative Norton, and that bill made it all the way to the end, but at the end of the day, there wasn't money to fund it. And so in the meantime, we are doing a bit better this year, as everybody knows, with our state finances. I don't know if there's going to be money that Representative Huntley is going to have, if he's going to have any kind of a target available, but in the case that he does, we want to bring this issue back up and try to move it forward. But as you read this amendment, this is a little bit broader. It's asking for more money than last year, and there are lots of different groups. I think we've been talking about this here today. A lot of needs to be addressed in minority communities, a lot of different health needs. And this amendment is specifically focusing on women's issues. It's not only the issues that were raised about the particular organization we heard from last year, which sounded like a terrific organization doing wonderful work, but we know that the needs are much broader than that. And we need to look in particular at the health needs of women from minority communities. And so that's what this amendment is about. And of course, this amendment, if it goes on, and the next amendment, we'll send this to the Finance Committee. But we definitely want Representative Huntley's committee to be able to consider, if there is money available, that it could perhaps go to this cause. And this amendment also requires the Commissioner of Health to develop a methodology for program outcomes, which I think is very important because, as we know, this is taxpayer money, and we need to make sure that we're accountable for it and that we're using it in ways that actually improve health and move us toward the goals that we all want to move for. So that is the amendment. Be happy to take questions on that if members have them before we vote. Representative Abler.
Madam Chair, it's a good amendment, and I'm glad this topic can get in the mix. I have a bill somewhat similar, and I think you've made a good idea even better, so we should all say yes today.
Thank you, Representative Abler. And is there anyone who wants to testify on the amendment for or against? All right. Not seeing any. So all those in favor of the amendment, please say, oh, I'm sorry, and Representative Moran, you're the author of the bill. I need to give you a chance. Please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As we know, we can look at this. 50% of white households are headed by women. So within communities of color, that number is even greater. And I think when we begin to look at helping women of color and look at how they can be more preventive in the healthcare arena, which not only impacts them, but impacts their family, impacts their children, impacts the community, and impacts our states, that we are on a better direction of creating better outcomes, health outcomes for all of us. So my hope is that as we begin to look further at how we can begin to reduce disparities, is how we begin to look better at what creating better health outcomes look like for diverse communities, that we can allow women of color to be a leading entity of finding the solutions to what works best for the community that they represent. So I just want to thank you so much for bringing this amendment forward. And in my hope as a legislature, that we can begin to create policies that really represent all of us and create better outcomes for all the members of our great state.
Thank you, Representative Moran. And I've been reminded that your bill probably would have to go to finance anyway because it task forces carry a cost. Mm-hmm. So just want to make that clear that I'm not derailing your bill with this amendment and sending it somewhere it wouldn't otherwise go. So,
yep, and Madam Chair, again, in working with the Council of Black Minnesotans, also with the Department of Health, and on the point of the task force and creating a couple of different task force, my hope is that as this bill travels, that we are going to be working with them in ways that we can collaborate and just working with the Department of Health in creating the Center for Health Equity, mm-hmm. Which is, I think, will help bring a more cohesive group together to create the better outcomes for the communities of color.
All right. Thank you, Representative Moran. So all in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Motion prevails. And the amendment is adopted. And then we have another amendment. And members, in your packet, you also have an A1, which was, I think, is just an earlier version of the one that we just adopted. So we're not intending to move that. At least I'm not. And then we have the A4 amendment, and that's Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move the A4 amendment. And I think this actually kind of brings together the two themes that we've had so far in this hearing, which is the need to have a strong mental health system, and as well as one that health system that can address health disparities and deal with the fact that we don't have enough culturally specific and native language speaking providers for many of our communities. And this amendment, we have been working with a variety of people through the interim with our state agencies, trying to address the issue of mental health issues within the immigrant and refugee community, many of whom, as you can imagine, did not make a choice to move here, but were uprooted because of civil war, very violent actions, civil decay in the structures of government, and have often experienced some real traumatic experiences before they came here in adjusting, and then were asked to adjust to a place that has a different culture, a different language, different ways of doing business. And you can imagine that on top of a mental health issue can be very difficult. And while I really appreciate Representative Moran's work on that of Ms. Anderson to make sure that we get a pipeline of health professionals who represent the diversity of Minnesota. Until then, we really need to make sure that the health professionals who are working with these individuals really understand the latest research, have the best cultural sensitivity that we can in terms of understanding how to help these people with the mental health challenges that they confront. And so this amendment would appropriate $75,000. We'll still, before we get to finance, refine that, but to create some training opportunities for people who are in the mental health field to really understand how to better work with these communities in introducing them to a range of mental health support services that were just not present in the places where they came from. And there's some real hesitancy about understanding the role of that can play in improving the lives of themselves and their family. And so that, with that, I would be glad to answer any questions. But it's been an effort that's been ongoing to try and figure out how to step up for the Somali community as well as other refugee and immigrant groups that have come here.
All right. Thank you, Representative Loeffler. I'm sorry. We do have a question. Representative Mack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a question for the author of the amendment. I'm just wondering, who would be expected? Well, I guess, I'm sorry. Okay, so we're expecting community representatives, mental health advocates will be sought to attend this. I guess my concern is one, maybe I'm not remembering, but is this kind of a new direction? Have we ever done something where we appropriate something to put on a conference, more or less, I would imagine, a voluntary conference? Is this something that has been done before? It's just kind of a different idea, and I like the direction that we're going. I'm just wondering the bang for the buck in terms of participating, getting people there. If it's one conference at one location, you know, maybe some of these folks might not have the means to get to something. A lot of times it's outreach, you know, mobilizing from clinic to clinic or community to community or town halls or something like that. I'm just trying to get my head around if something like this has been done, has it been successful, or is this a whole new approach to something like this with a one-time conference is how I'm reading it.
Representative Loeffler.
Madam Chair and members, Representative Mack, whether or not this has happened before in the past, I can't address. I know it evolved out of the discussions because but I think in every profession, you tend to have conferences that bring in national resources or people with special expertise that you couldn't have, you know, maybe doing a round robin around the state, that sort of thing. And so that was the concept, was that we would be able to bring people together who have a patient load that includes people with these kind of backgrounds and have them have a chance to really get a much more in-depth understanding of how to work with this community and its members and be more successful in the health outcomes that everyone wants to see. And so this was the suggestion that had come out as one of the best ways. Now, whether or not, you know, you have to get permission from speakers about whether you can videotape and, you know, have these trainings live on, I think we're getting better and better at making sure that these aren't just one-time opportunities, but you oftentimes have to get the permission from, you know, the experts that come in to be able to do that. And I think that's why we've asked for this planning committee to work towards, you know, trying to see how to make this live as an ongoing opportunity for people who are trying to better approach mental health issues with the immigrant refugee community and our Somali residents.
Okay. Yeah, thank you, Representative Mack. And I can address it a bit, too, because I've been very closely involved in this over the interim, and we had many meetings, and including, you know, with a lot of different people. And we at first became aware from some advocates that the Somali community in particular has some particular issues around mental health, as I think Representative Loeffler was saying, cultural issues and issues about whether those needs are being met and how to meet them. And it became apparent after some work that there are pockets of people doing work on this. And so this idea of having a conference was an attempt to bring those who are working on it together so that there can be sort of we can sort of find out who's doing what, and they can kind of cross-educate each other and perhaps jumpstart some efforts that are less siloed and less fragmented. So that was kind of thinking on it, and appreciate Representative Loeffler carrying the ball and making sure this actually becomes something that hopefully will be workable. Are there other questions from members? Okay, anybody in the audience who wants to testify for or against this amendment? Okay, not seeing anybody. Representative Moran, do you want to comment on the amendment? Do you support it? Or because it is your bill.
Right. So. Madam Chair,
Representative Loeffler. The one thing that I do know in the African, especially the African-American community, you know, mental illness is not something that we readily talk about or want to identify with. And it carries a stigma, right? And so I'm just trying to wrap my head around it. And I just don't know how to respond to that because so often, you know, what happens is that we create conference and we invite people into a community that takes them out of their community and take them out of their comfort zone and take them out of what they're so used to, which is really, really important for communities of color. And so I'm just trying to wrap my head around what that would look like. I think it's a great idea. I think that we can definitely, you know, the communities of color need to be more informed. They need to be more educated, more engaged in it. We need to be able to be removed from the stigma of mental illness. All those things need to happen so that the illness can be addressed. And so my hope is this go forward, and as we look at creating that conference, that conference really comes from the community about what would work, what is best for them, and what's going to create the best outcome for the community that we know the issues are impacting them in a really a negative way. So I just want to thank you so much for bringing it forward, and it's definitely a need.
Right, Representative Loeffler.
And Madam Chair, one of the things that I didn't bring up that I think is important for people to understand is that I've been told by some people from the Somali community that they don't even have the words in their language to even talk about this. And so, you know, it's very difficult when someone is struggling with this and then they're brought into a Western healthcare setting in which all these long words that we use are brought in, and they just, I mean, there isn't just the context in which to, how to approach a family, how to have that dialogue, how to get people to the place they need to be. And I think there's almost no Somali practitioners. That's true of some of these other groups as well, that we just don't have enough people who are trained. And so we really do need to figure out a way to have those who are doing this work strengthen and increase their capacity to have those conversations so that they're successful and they lead to good health outcomes for the people who are here.
Okay, members, I think we're ready to vote on the amendment. So all those in favor of the A4, Representative Loeffler renews her motion. And all those in favor of the A4 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Motion prevails. And we're on the bill. And is there anyone in the audience who wants to testify for or against the bill as amended? So, okay. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. This is a relatively small bill in comparison. My name is Twyla Braze, President of Citizens Council for Health Freedom. This is a relatively small bill compared to some previous bills, but I just want to remind you about some of the things about health disparities as you consider moving forward with this bill. One, health disparities is not only about race, it is about ethnicity, socioeconomic status, gender, literacy level, sexual orientation, disability status, geography, religion, age, and mental health. And that's according to several federal major reports on the issue. Secondly, the HHS put out an action plan titled The Nation Free of Disparities, which it said that disparities are essentially real, but they're linked with social, economic, and environmental, but they're often driven by the social conditions in which individuals live, learn, work, and play, as opposed to the doctors. Now, the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights released a major report called The Healthcare Challenge, and two of the commissioners gave a dissenting report. And one of the things that they said was that the report goes way beyond enforcement to advocate not only a new bureaucracy but a national strategy to achieve a leveling of healthcare delivery, research, and financing. And they called it a thinly veiled endorsement of universal healthcare. that advocates policies to achieve specific outcomes where market failures have not been demonstrated. And in fact, the report was not able to prove disparate treatment or intentional discrimination. And I thought the most interesting, because this is a conversation about having doctors for different categories of people. And so what I thought was interesting about their report was that they said that the disparities are real, but their meaning is misinterpreted. They talked about lifestyle issues, drug use, sexual behavior, diet, smoking, etc. And they said the cultural competency doctrine is a dangerous distraction from the real challenges we face with healthcare today. It's dangerous because it stresses identity politics over patient care and would substitute group-based generalizations for individual evaluations. It assumes that doctors, because of either conscious or unconscious bias, cannot communicate effectively with their patients who are culturally different or of another race, and that this leads to fewer procedures, which in turn leads to more illness among minorities. They said there's no evidence that race is a major determinant of how patients select their doctors. Now, the interesting thing that I would like to point out is how many American doctors from every class go to another country.
I'm sorry, we have limited time. Could you please stick to the bill? I take it you're opposed to it.
Madam Chair, I am sticking to the bill. This is talking about foreign doctors, training foreign doctors. My point is that there are many doctors, American doctors, that go over to other countries, and they provide health care to people in other countries, and they are not any part of the other country's culture. They are physicians who look at patients, and they look at the problems within the patient themselves. It's not about all of these other disparities. It's about a patient and a doctor. And it is unfortunate that we look at everything in that phase, that you have to have a doctor who looks like you or has a cultural idea like you, because the fact of the matter is, will these foreign-trained doctors then, as a result of getting training, will they be forced only to provide services for people who look like them or people who treat or are part of their culture or people who have their language? What if a Somali doctor wants to move to Tennessee, whereas there's not a Somali anywhere? And so it's not a good idea to think in the identity politics, but better to be thinking about a patient and a doctor. A fine thing to have foreign-trained doctors, but not a fine thing to look at this as an issue just about health disparities. That trained doctor should be able to treat any patient of any color and any persuasion because he's a doctor and because the patient's a patient.
All right, thank you. I think I'm not seeing any questions, so I think we can move on to vote on the bill. So Representative Moran is going to renew her motion that House File 2361, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All those opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Moran. Okay. Unfortunately, we lost Representative Dorholt again, so Representative Allen, if you could get ready and do your 2248 Safe Harbor Bill. So we're going to take up House File 2248. All right. Representative Allen moves that House File 2248 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. And we have an author's amendment to get the bill in the shape that she would like it discussed. And so Representative Allen moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor of the A1, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Motion prevails. And the bill is before us with the A1 on it. And go ahead, Representative Allen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. This bill basically expands the duties of the Director of Child
sex trafficking prevention, and then it appropriates money for the general fund to the Commissioners of Human Services and Health. And this will build on the work that we did last year so that we can continue to build a statewide system for sex trafficking prevention, and then continue to fund culturally appropriate trauma-based services for sexually exploited youth. And I have the advocate here who would like to testify briefly.
All right. Thank you, Representative Allen. And members, this bill is mainly a finance bill. It's really here because it has just one minor change to the language from last year, correct? And so that's what we're here to discuss. Representative Allen?
Madam Chair, I also wanted to mention that we will have the Department of Health has an amendment here, but we can do that in finance because it's relating to the appropriation, so we'll take care of that there, if that's okay.
Okay, right. Yeah, if that's just related to the appropriation piece, that's because I don't think we have that today anyway.
Right.
Okay, so welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I'm Jeff Bauer. I'm the Director of Public Policy at the Family Partnership. First of all, just want to say thank you. I think over half of you have been authors of the Safe Harbor Bill and are again this session, so thank you for believing in this and supporting it over the past couple of years. Just to give you a really quick overview, we came out of the last legislative session with $2.8 million, and of that, $1 million was for safe harbor shelter and housing, and another $1 million of it was for the statewide structure of staffing and supports for the project. And so we're trying to come back and continue the work this year, and one of the big pieces of that work is we weren't able to secure any funds for this grant fund that Representative Allen talked about, which is the whole range of comprehensive services that child sex trafficking victims need, all the way from civil legal services to job placement, mental health, those kinds of things. And so the policy language in the bill, all the policy language in the bill is doing is authorizing the Safe Harbor Director position that was created last year to administer that grant fund should we obtain those funds this session.
Okay, questions for members? All right, not seeing any. Is there anybody in the audience who wants to testify for or against the bill? Okay, not seeing anybody, so thank you. We're going to, Representative Allen is going to renew her motion in House File 2248 as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, no. Motion prevails. Thank you,
Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Representative Allen, you have another bill, which is 2410. So Representative Allen is going to move House File 2410, and this one will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Right. Okay, and welcome to the committee, Representative Allen.
Madam Chair, members, this is a bill that is basically a department bill, and this is something that is a work in progress, meaning that the first, in order to, if you look at the bill, the proposed bill, culturally specific programs are added as programs that are eligible for higher rates, and so the current law states that programs serving special populations, so that is now under this bill we would be changed to culturally specific programs. And then section one of the bill defines culturally specific program, and that to draft this definition, it was a work of many stakeholders. I'm trying to find out here the. It was basically a work group that was put together by the department, and I have a testifier here who can talk more about that process. But there was some concern. I don't know if we have anybody said it was going to oppose the bill, but I think there was some misunderstanding about what this bill really does, and really it sets up the definition, which was worked on by the which was drafted by the work group, and so then if you look at the bill, there are rules that would provide further criteria, and then the working group will continue and they will come up with guidelines that will further define or set forth the criteria that programs so that they will satisfy this definition. And that's probably very convoluted there, but basically I think that what I'm trying to stress is that this is something that is developing, and that this gives the basis for approving those programs for the special rate. So I'll let that
right. We'll let Mr. Hartford address that. Thank you, Representative Allen. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, committee members. I'm Dave Hartford. I'm DHS Assistant Commissioner for Chemical and Mental Health Services. And just to say a little bit about this bill, I think there's been a lot of discussion this afternoon that kind of grounds this work, in that it was really recognized that we could do a better job with communities of color as far as inclusiveness and in how we develop our programs. So this last year, there was a piece of reimbursement, if you will, for chemical dependency providers that provided culturally specific programs. But in the language, there really wasn't a definition, and it was not working well to actually regulate or for licensing to work with. So over the past year, we convened a work group of between 15 and 20 agencies that serve communities of color, culturally specific programs providing chemical dependency services. And that group worked on language that would actually provide a definition of culturally, what does it mean to be a culturally specific program? And that's the language you see before you, was really drafted by that work group. The intent is to have this piece of language start to have some foundation around what does that mean to have culturally specific programming. There is also a rule that's in place that has been in place to regulate these programs. And then lastly, we intend to move forward, as this is a work in process, to really work through developing guidelines so licensing and providers can better understand what does it mean to implement quality programming. So we've got the definition, we've got rules in place, and we will work with the newly formed DHS Cultural and Ethnic Communities Leadership Council. They just had their first meeting and their report to the legislature this February. We will continue to work with that body to develop guidelines so programs can be more specific to ensure that we have quality programming within this culturally specific framework.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Hartford. Questions? Representative Albright?
To the author, Madam Chair. Is there a model that you are using as a template for this new subdivision, or is this something that will be created in collaboration with the stakeholders?
Representative Allen?
Madam Chair, Representative, I'll state briefly, and then the testifier can add to this, but or answer your question about any specific types of programs. But my understanding is that these programs exist. They've been, some of them there is research, evidence-based, and others, funding has, a lot of the traditional treatment models are well-funded, well-researched, they're accepted, but for culturally specific programs, some of them have been in existence for decades, but they're not well-researched. So this is going to give guidelines so that these programs can demonstrate how they're culturally specific, and so that and
So that's really the purpose of it. It's not to dictate what those programs should be in this legislation. That will be worked out through the guidelines and with all the stakeholders involved.
And just, members, I don't know if there are any more questions, but we've reached the end of our committee time. We could finish this bill if we can do it quickly, one would hope. And then just so everyone in the room knows, we're going to be in recess until 6 o'clock, and we're going to come back to room 10. So if you're here for other bills, just so you know, we'll be back at 6. Other questions? Representative Albright, Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Allen, I guess when I look at this, I just think an enhanced rate for substance treatment abuse, to me the rate should be the same regardless of whether it's culturally specific or not. Or what am I not understanding?
We should ask maybe...
It's my understanding that these type of programs are already receiving an enhanced rate. We're just changing the name of how they're described under the statute, and then also providing a definition. So many of the programs are already culturally specific, and they're getting the higher rate. That's in the current statute. Is that Mr. Hartford?
Madam Chair, members, yes, that's accurate, that these have existed for a number of years, receiving the rate, and this is... moving in the direction of being more specific, making definitions more robust, and creating interpretive guidelines so we can do a better job of assuring that these are delivering the quality that is intended.
Okay, Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I just a little feedback. You know, I guess we're all Americans, and our parents and my grandparents were immigrants, and just about everybody here had immigrant parents. I just think it should be the same rate right across the board. And, you know, our national motto is E Pluribus Unum, out of many one. Not Unum E Pluribus, out of one creating many. And so I just think this points us in the wrong direction to a certain degree. And, again, that's just my initial impression. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Grunhagen. And I think what the testimony is that this isn't creating a new program of doing that. It's just adding some better definitions. So... Okay, I'm not seeing any other questions, members. I think we're ready to vote unless there's anyone in the audience. Oh, I'm sorry, we're not voting. We're just going to have it laid over. So this bill will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And now we will be in recess until 6
Thank
o'clock
you,
in room 10. Thank you. All right, the committee will come back to order. And thank you, members. I hope you all got a little dinner and got a bit of a break. We're going to take up House File 2472, Representative Dorholt. And Representative Dorholt's not on the committee, so I will move that House File 2472 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. And I'm also going to move the A1 author's amendment to get the bill in the shape that Representative Dorholt would like to discuss it in. And so we need to vote on the amendment. I'll move the A1. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Motion prevails. And we're all set. Representative Dorholt.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for working with me during a busy day. So HF 2472, as we all know, identifying and treating mental illness early is the most effective in cost terms.
Representative Dorholt, yes. I'm having trouble hearing you. Could you pull the mic? You don't have to do that, I don't think.
All right.
There we go.
You got it. Okay, so we have mobile crisis teams around the state, however not in every county, which would be great. And we want to clarify that these teams can go out and work to engage people voluntarily in treatment, so they don't have to wait until there is a full-blown emergency and the person meets the criteria for commitment or hospitalization. Specifically to this bill, Section 1 adds ACT teams, assertive community treatment, crisis stabilization, partial hospitalization to the types of community programs that can be used under Minnesota's early intervention law under the Commitment Act. Section 2 clarifies that peer support specialists can be used on mobile crisis teams. Section 3, you'll see, clarifies that they can assess whether the person, these teams can assess whether the person might be willing to accept treatment voluntarily, check to see if they have an advance directive, and take down information from the family or caretakers also allows the team to provide family psychoeducation so that they know how to help their loved ones. Section 4 will stress the skills of treatment, engagement, strategies, and working with families. Section 5 ensures that there is a warm handoff when referrals are made, rather than just handing the person a card and say, hey, call this number. You're going to get something set up firsthand, and has the crisis team work on developing an advanced directive. Section 6 will add an advanced directive to the person's file if they have one. So with that, I guess we'll...
That is the bill. And Ms. Abderholden, it's good to see you again.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I guess we just have a lot going on this session. So Sue Abderholden, NAMI, Minnesota. You know, I take a lot of calls from family members who are concerned about their loved one, and often on the weekends, because everybody seems to have my cell phone. And one thing I can tell you is I've never gotten calls from families who say, I want to commit my loved one. What they're always calling to say is, I want to get my loved one into treatment. And so when we looked at this and we looked at our mobile crisis teams, we said, well, is there a way that we can get treatment earlier to people? And actually, you know, in our statute on it, we differentiate between a mental health crisis and a mental health emergency. But for all practical purposes, the teams aren't really differentiating. And so we often hear from family members where they call the team comes out and they say, well, you know, do you want to go in for treatment? And the person says no. And so then they wait, and so they can wait several days, and then the family calls again and the team comes out again. And not until they meet hospital level criteria or the criteria in the Commitment Act do they actually then bring the person in. And I kind of liken this to, you know, if you're calling 911 and you're saying you have chest pain, they would never say to you, well, wait until it's a full-blown heart attack. We really want people to come out early. And with a very skilled mental health professional, they can really, you know, you don't come out once. You come out the next day and the day after that and really work to develop that trust with that person and get them into treatment. I think we'll be able to avoid, actually, hospitalizations. I think we can, you know, intervene earlier before the person gets so sick that that's the level of care that they need. I think we could avoid, frankly, people being committed. And these days with, you know, those are public records. If you go to the Supreme Court website, you can find out if someone was committed or not, and that sometimes interferes with housing. So I think just all the way around, we can get people engaged in treatment earlier and kind of prevent some of the bad things from happening. And that's why we brought this bill forward.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Abderholden. Are there questions from members? Okay, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Representative Lealy. And mine's really not a question. I just want to say thank you. I consistently hear about the need for this being done. I hear it from health professionals. I hear it from law enforcement. I hear it from citizens and my neighbors. And I just think it's good news. Thank you very much.
We have indeed. One other testifier, please come on up. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good evening, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to speak in support of House File 2472. My name is Grace Tangyard-Schmidt, and I'm with Guild Incorporated, a private, not-for-profit community mental health agency in the metropolitan area. We provide an array of recovery-focused, intensive outpatient treatment and rehabilitation services for folks who have schizophrenia, schizoaffective disorder, bipolar disorder, and other serious mental illnesses. And over the years, we've had the opportunity to demonstrate how alternatives can be created for people who are facing involuntary treatment and rates of commitment reduced. I am a NAMI member, and today I also represent the Minnesota Association of Community Mental Health Programs. I'll make just 3 points to highlight the bill's value. But as I prepared for speaking today, I thought about our client John and his mom, Stella. They came to my mind as I was thinking about the value of this bill. And I just want to tell you a bit about him. When we met John, he was living in the woods. He had lost his wife, his daughter, his home, and his job, all related to untreated schizoaffective disorder and untreated substance abuse disorder. We reached out to him and were successfully able to engage him in a treatment plan to begin to better his situation. He moved from being homeless to being housed, from untreated mental illness to well-treated mental illness, from untreated substance use disorder to sobriety, from unemployment to full-time employment. He was then laid off when his employer moved his business out of state, and John's health began to change. We stepped up the frequency of our contacts to 2 and 3 times a week. His team thought that things were then under control. And then his mother, Stella, called Julie, the team leader. "Julie," she said, "it's back. It's like it was before he started with you." And Julie listened carefully. John's mother was seeing very early signs of deteriorating health. The signs that she saw were too subtle for us to see, even though that we had worked with him for 6 years and we thought we had things in good hand, in good order. She saw that declining health before we could see it. We stepped up our contacts again, and bottom line, we were able to intervene early enough and with success such that John didn't lose his home and commitment for involuntary treatment was avoided. Today, John's health is stable, and he is again working full-time. So the first value of this bill is that it calls on those who are making mental health crisis assessments to include information and history from family members. These illnesses are chronic health conditions, and as with other chronic conditions, symptoms flare up from time to time. Sometimes we know why, and sometimes we don't. Our experience is that involved family members are the first to recognize the change. Additionally, with this bill, services to stabilize the crisis situation will incorporate education and support for families, which contribute positively to an individual's recovery. Secondly, the bill expands treatment alternatives for court-ordered early intervention. This increases the opportunity for individuals to get on board with a plan to stabilize their health and their situation without the use of high-cost hospitalization. One of the alternatives added is assertive community treatment. It's known, and some of you may know, it's known as a hospital without walls, in that a multidisciplinary team of professionals provides comprehensive treatment in the community. It's an economical alternative to inpatient hospitalization. And finally, the new language elevates the importance of sustained effort on the part of those providing crisis intervention and stabilization services to engage individuals in treatment. It is an essential strategy to help prevent a mental health crisis from becoming an emergency. At times, for a variety of reasons, individuals living with mental illnesses may be reticent to seek or accept help. Continuing efforts to reach out and engage individuals to take root in a plan to enhance their well-being can make all the difference in one's self-management of their illness and their recovery. There are the 3 points. The value of the bill is in its involvement of families, the addition of community-based treatment alternatives, and its call for sustained effort to engage individuals in voluntary treatment as part of crisis stabilization. Thank you for your kind attention.
Thank you very much. Any questions for members? Don't see any. Thank you very much for your testimony. So, Representative Dorholt, do you have any closing words before we vote on the bill?
Thank you.
Okay, that's great.
Good comment.
Okay, so I'm going to renew my motion that House File 2472 be re-referred as amended to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Motion prevails. Thank you. Representative Benson. Okay, I'm going to go tap him on the shoulder. Here, we got that. So we're going to take up House File 1898.
To speak.
Yep.
Okay, where does it go?
Chair Liebling, I understand House File 1898 will be re-referred to the Committee on State Government Finance.
Yes,
if you'd like
Chair,
to,
that would be my motion.
If you'd like to move your bill, I guess I moved it for you.
Yes, between us, we did it. So maybe we should just make it clear. So I would move that House File 1898 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. I'm sorry, what did you...
State Government Finance.
Sorry about that. Good thing I've got you helping me.
I understand you have two amendments.
Well, first, Mr. Chair, I'd just like to put on the first amendment, which would be the DE2. So I would move the DE2 amendment.
All right, Governor Lee, Governor, Chair Liebling, we're looking to the future here. Chair Liebling moves the DE2 amendment to get it into the language you prefer. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
I hope nobody was opposed.
I'm not going to go to the second one yet.
It's like Russia. There's no votes allowed.
Do we have to have people who vote no? All right.
We don't allow that.
All right.
Yes. We're very cooperative.
Okay.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks, members, for sticking around, coming back to hear this bill. And this bill is a response to a hearing that we held, an interim hearing. Maybe some of you were here when we talked about the Board of Nursing. This started out with that issue that many of you read in the Star Tribune about some issues that the board had had. And we had a joint hearing with their counterpart committee in the Senate on this during the interim and started to talk about some possible ways that we could strengthen the Board of Nursing. And from those discussions, we started to focus a little bit more on the HPSP, which is the Health Professionals Services Program. So this is, I just want to say at the outset that this is really a work in progress still, although I understand that our latest iteration of it, which you all just were kind enough to adopt, is much more acceptable to more parties than the previous version, and which I'm glad to hear. What I would like to do is, of course, hear from some of those parties this evening, and eventually this bill is going to be part of our omnibus policy bill, so we are hoping to get some good input, really continue to work on the language, get input from all of you and come up with something that is really workable, because the HPSP program, of course, affects more boards than just the nursing board. It's the organization or the program that's available to help licensed professionals who find themselves in difficulty with any of a number of problems. Chemical dependency is a main one we think of, but it can also be health problems that impact their ability to practice. And that program is designed to, it's a voluntary program for the most part. I mean, obviously, people don't recover unless they are invested in their recovery, but it's designed to monitor people to help them practice safely if they can do so, continue to practice or recover and be able to come back to practice whenever possible. So this really deals with the interaction between that program and the various health-related licensing boards that interact with it. So this is our attempt to smooth out some of the bumps, perhaps, and hopefully make this all work a little bit better for everybody. So let me just, I was going to ask Lynn Aves from House Research to kind of walk through the bill, but her voice is not working so well. So I'm going to have to sort of stumble through this myself, if you'll bear with us. And if I say anything wrong, she can give me the hand signals. So I'm just going to kind of walk you through her summary here and let you know what we're doing. And then hopefully we're going to hear from a lot of testifiers who are going to talk to us about
maybe fill in some of the gaps and maybe talk to us about what they like or don't like about what we're trying to do here. And I should say, too, that there is also an amendment in your packet, which is Representative Abler's amendment. And I am happy to take that amendment. Maybe we should move that now because I know Representative Abler has to leave at a certain point, and I know he'd like to be here when we discuss that.
Great. Thanks, Madam Chair. So I'd like to move the A1 amendment.
All right, A1 amendment has been moved.
Mr. Chair, there's an oral amendment I have to offer. I'd have Ms. Aves do it, but we're just beating her up. She is the most awesome staff person on this topic. So since she can't say anything to undo that, she'll have to accept the compliment. So on line 1.15, I'd like to change the F parenthesis. That should be an E instead. And then on line 121, it should be change to 2011 to 2014. Ms. Saves, is that the only two after me? Okay, thanks. And so I'll incorporate that,
okay,
Mr. Chair. And let me explain the amendment to people. There are three or four parts to this. There's lots of ways to handle criminal sexual conduct offenses. A couple of years ago, there was an issue with a chiropractor who we actually couldn't nab because he was after the fact, but we decided to have a very thoughtful process. This is the language the chiropractor has adopted, that the House actually proposed all professions have this language, and it's a 10-year rebuttable bar. It's a lifetime bar, 10 years. It's rebuttable after 10 years if you've been behaved, and it's for some very serious offenses, and it's worked really well. For full disclosure, the Board of Medical Practice has a one-and-done version, which we thought was a little harsh. And so this is thoughtful. These people have invested maybe 12 years in their various credentials and professions, and they won't be practicing anytime soon, but eventually they could, if the board decided, they could deem them rehabilitated. The second thing is on lines 2.13 to 2.28, allowing the executive directors of the boards to authorize an investigation. And the section 3, which the action word is on page 3, line 3, that they shall coordinate. And a lot of times the boards want to coordinate, but the other agencies don't. And so now they have to coordinate. So this would be useful as they investigate issues. And then finally, section 4 needs a little bit of work. The point is that the boards shall promote the health professional services program. And I think we'll have a better amendment when the bill is marked up. I wanted them to promote it, and the website would be a limited promotion. I wanted them to mail it out, but they only mail postcards, and there's not really room for any big news on there. And I wanted them to do this without any burden on the boards. I worked on the boards with this language, and I believe they're comfortable with it. And so as this goes forward, if anybody in the public has a concern about this, I'm very happy to talk to them about any concerns they have. And just to say, Mr. Chair and members, we have really well-functioning licensing boards. They're not perfect. I still am afraid of mine. A letter comes to tell me happy birthday. It's like, oh, no, what are they being charged with, which is probably how they like it. Their number one job is to protect the public, and the second is to coordinate the professional functions and maintain the high level that we've come to expect of our licensees and in some case, registrants and whatever. But for all the talk, I think the problems need to be addressed or require a small adjustment, if you will, not anything in terms of an overhaul. And I think with some Liebling's work and with this, that the updating to these board functions, I think, will be a very good update. And there's discussions about who shall oversee the program, and I'm not in full agreement with Representative Liebling about that it should go to admin or not, but on the rest of the stuff, there's a lot of good work in these two bills, and so I would urge members to support the amendment.
Any further discussion or questions about the A1 amendment, the Abler amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed? Ayes have it.
Mr. Chair and Madam Chair, I appreciate that.
All right. Thank you, Representative Abler. And I appreciate that help because, you know, Representative Abler had mentioned this to me and said, you should look at this language, and I just didn't have time to do that. And he brought the amendment and did the work on that. And I think it's a big help to this bill. So thank you. So members, Mr. Chair, if I may, I'll walk through the overview of the bill as we just adopted the DE. So first of all, what we're doing in sections 1 and 2 is we're saying that the current language in the law is optional about the health-related boards contracting with the HPSB program. So what these two sections do is they say that the health boards have to contract with HPSB and vice versa. HPSB has to contract with them. So instead of an option, this is now, under this bill, a necessity. Everybody's got to be in on this because this is our program for the state to deal with these issues. Okay, then the Section 3, one of the things we're doing here is changing the oversight of HPSB. And so this subdivision or this section, Section 3, establishes the HPSB committee, which would be composed of at least three, but no more than six, executive directors of health-related licensing boards, and then two members of the advisory committee. And from what I understand, the advisory committee right now is composed of, is the group that has the associations on it. So you've got the boards with their executive directors, and then right now you have this other body with the associations, like the MNA, Minnesota Nurses Association, et cetera. So we're setting up the HPSB committee to be 3 to 6 executive directors and two members of this advisory committee. So there would be some representation from the associations. It would still be largely governed by the professional executive directors from the boards. And under the bill, these people would set the program budget, and they would require the boards to put in their share of administration costs and expenses. So all the boards would be are funding this, as they are now, out of their fees that they charge licensees. And they would continue to do that, but this group would set the program budget and generally oversee the program. This section also transfers authority for, I'm not sure this is the right language. I think this might need to be worked on a bit, but that the Department of Administration would do some of the management. Right now this is being done, I think right now, by the Board of Dentistry. But we'd like to shift that to the Department of Administration that is used to doing this for a lot of different smaller groups that we have in state government and doing things like operating payroll and just kind of the administrative functions. Paragraph C authorizes the Commissioner of Administration to hire the staff and to pay the program expenses. I'm not sure if we may need to get this a bit straightened out. Then we have the advisory committee, which would have one representative of each professional association whose members are eligible for the program and two public members. Let's see. So the paragraph or section 4 of the bill requires the health licensing boards, if they receive notice that one of their licensees has been discharged from the HPSB program because of noncompliance or voluntary withdrawal, this would require them to temporarily suspend the credential of that person if they have probable cause to believe that their continued practice presents an imminent risk of harm. So we kind of went back and forth on this. There was an issue about a potential gap between when somebody gets discharged or essentially flunks out of the HPSB program. Say they're chemically dependent, they're being monitored, they stop doing their drug testing, they stop going to their treatment, etc. And the program says, you're done, you're not complying, you're out. Well, as it exists today, at least for the Board of Nursing, and I'm not sure about the other boards, but it can take quite a while before an investigation is done and that person's license is suspended, say they're continuing to use. And that gap presents a really unacceptable risk to the public in a lot of cases because that person continues to have their license. Their employer may not know, that they have this issue, and you know, they're in some cases this can be really quite risky. So what we're doing here is saying that the board, at the point that the person flunks out, their health board has to consider whether the person presents an imminent risk of harm, and if they do, they have to temporarily suspend their license while they go through the complete process, the due process part that they have to do of getting all the information and going through a regular investigation and issuing a final order. And that process can take some time. And that's why we've said we're going to require them to immediately consider whether this person is presenting a risk. And if they do that, they have to schedule, you can see in the bill that they have to schedule a hearing within 60 days, and they have to give 20 days of notice to the regulated person. So there are these requirements. You know, it's a requirement of due process. You can't just yank somebody's professional license. You have to go through steps where the person has a chance to respond. But we're trying to kind of strike a balance for public safety and with the person's due process rights to be able to get a little more control over that situation. We also have in this bill draft a requirement that the program manager of HPSP has to report to the appropriate board whenever one of the participants has caused identifiable patient harm or has substituted or adulterated medications, written a prescription in the name of a person or veterinary patient for personal use, or should be monitored by the provisions of sections 241.17 to 214, I'm sorry, 214.17 to 214.25. And I'm not sure what those are, and maybe Ms. Aves can help us by writing me a note to tell me. Another important provision that we're changing in this bill is, and this is something that the Board of Nursing asked us for, in order to shorten this gap, close this gap, to make the failing out of the HPSP program, to make that in itself grounds for discipline, so that the board can act in a quicker way without having to go and find and investigate some other grounds. So this, one hopes, will close the gap on that if they violate the terms of their participation agreement or leave the program without fulfilling the terms for successful completion. Then there's a section here, Section 7, that requires the boards and the Commissioner of Health, upon receiving a complaint, to temporarily suspend the credential of a regulated person when there's probable cause to believe that continued practice presents an imminent risk of harm. So same idea there. Let's see. So I think that's more or less it. And there are some issues here that we've gone back and forth on. And so I think, I don't know if members feel that they need more just information about the program itself. We've been through this before in this committee, I believe. So I think, you know, if people have questions about the program director is here, and I'm sure she'd be glad to give you more information.
Okay, Representative Liebling, I see you have two testifiers. Should we invite them up?
Sure.
Marshall Schwag? Is that how you pronounce it? Schrag, yeah.
And just to be clear, Mr. Chair, they're not really my testifiers, but certainly
testifiers.
Everybody in this room are my testifiers. Because
very good.
I want them to come and tell me what they think and tell the committee, you know, where the problems are in this draft, because we are definitely interested in making this work for everyone.
Welcome to committee, if you will identify yourself. And
thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Marshall Schrag, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Dentistry, and Representative Liebling is trying to disassociate herself from me, but I will carry on just the same. We really do appreciate the openness that Representative Liebling has shown in after introducing this bill. It did startle a number of us executive directors, and she indicated that she had introduced the bill to to create some discussion, and it certainly has done that. We believe that the amendment that you've passed tonight does significantly improve upon the bill and address many of our concerns. There are still a couple of issues that, on behalf of the executive directors of the boards of the health regulatory boards, I do want to bring to your attention. Specifically, Section 3, which deals with governance of the program, of the health professional services program. Currently, governance is established that there is an administering board, and the Board of Dentistry has been doing that for the last 6 or 7 years. We do do that cooperatively with the program and advisory committee. We have our own responsibilities in doing that. Representative Liebling had indicated the Department of Administration has got the SMART unit, which provides some administrative support. The SMART unit in the Department of Administration was actually developed based upon the administrative services unit that the health licensing boards had established many years ago, I believe close to 20 years ago or more. And so we do have those administrative support services within our within our services available for our programs, including all of the health regulatory boards and the health professional services program. They provide budgetary advice and oversight. They provide human resources support and oversight, and they provide purchasing and accounts receivable and accounts payable. So we do have those services, and so it is it's difficult for us to understand why, with no history of problems with the way that the board currently administers and provides governance to HPSP, why that would be moved to the Department of Administration. And in fact, the boards are concerned that moving this to the Department of Administration could actually increase costs with surcharges being added by the Department of Administration to the program services. It does separate the program, the HPSP program, from the boards, which are the organizations that both pay for and refer to HPSP, and need to have a close relationship with HPSP in order for both the boards and the HPSB to work best. I guess that's all I will say about that. The other concern that we've addressed together has to do with Section 4, and Section 4. Again, there's significant improvement in this over what had been an immediate suspension and a summary suspension of those who are discharged for noncompliance from HVSP. The issue that that we look at now, though, is the process, in that the scheduling of a disciplinary hearing through the Administrative Procedure Act would cause the boards to have to use the Office of Administrative Hearings to do what now many of the boards are doing internally, with a hearing before the board itself. For example, if our board does a temporary suspension or an immediate suspension, our process now is to have a hearing before the Board of Dentistry within 10 days of that suspension. And that permits the individual to appeal to the board and to address their due process rights within a very timely manner. If they still have an issue with the recommendation of the board to continue a suspension, they then have the right to appeal that to the Office of Administrative Hearings. We try to avoid the Office of Administrative Hearings as much as possible because of the costs involved in that. And we try to resolve things through mediation, through hearings before the board. And this process is something that, although it could, certainly could work, it is not necessarily the best approach. And again, it establishes a 20-day notice, and some of the boards like ours are already using a shorter period of time for that. And if you'll allow me, I think to go back to the original concern, which had to do with the management oversight. I think that the biggest concern that I have is that we're making some significant changes to the governance of the HPSP program at a time that HPSP is engaged in a strategic planning process. That strategic planning process is being facilitated by MAD, by the Management Analysis Division, of and through that process, HPSP is looking at not only its daily work process and decision making, but also its governance and oversight, and reviewing all of those procedures to make sure that the program remains relevant and responsive. And I would like to see that strategic planning process be able to work its way through before we make any decisions about governance, so that a well thought out oversight governance process can be discussed over a period of time and recommendations and decisions made. So I guess that's all I've got to say, and take any questions that you might have.
Committee, any questions or commentary? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just kind of wondering what the timeline is for that strategic planning process that you were just mentioning.
Sure. And Monica Feider is going to be speaking next. She's the program manager, and she is closest to that process and could address that. I think part of the process is that they've waited to have some executive directors assigned to a discussion process, and she's been given those names now. So that process, I know, will be continuing very shortly. I don't know what the conclusion date is. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
Any further questions from Mr. Schwab? Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Schwab, just because I'm still learning about this, when someone is suspended currently, is there an immediate notification to their employer? Are they required to report? Is there any issue with them applying to work for another employer and perhaps falsely claiming that they have a license or not disclosing? You know, is that a risk area? I can't remember all the particulars of some of the publicity around it, but I seem to think there was some issue related to that.
Mr. Schwab.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, indeed that is an issue when somebody is suspended. That's under a disciplinary action. And that does get posted on websites. It gets published. Some of the boards are required to send out a press release regarding that. Most of the boards report to the National Practitioner Data Bank, and so there is quite a public record that gets established about that. If an employer were looking to hire somebody, our hope on behalf of all the boards is that somebody looking to hire a healthcare professional would check with the boards to, which they can do online in most cases, to verify whether that individual has any public action that that would help them in their hiring decision, and that would certainly show up.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you.
Any further questions or discussion? Yes, Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just, I certainly support people being able to check those sources. You know, if we do criminal background checks, or you know, there are lots of checks on people that we need to do for everyone's safety and assurance. I'm just wondering if that public notification all hinders in any way people actually coming forth and seeking help. And if there's, how do we address that?
Mr. Schwab.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ward, I think that the concerns, at least on behalf of the boards, have been addressed with this amendment. The original bill called for a mandatory suspension for somebody that was being discharged. That's no longer an issue. Now we're looking at determining whether somebody has imminent risk of harm for practicing to make sure that once they leave HPSP and the monitoring that provides that security to the public and to the boards, that there's an opportunity then for the board to address the specific concerns about the licensee on an individual case-by-case basis.
Representative Ward? Any further questions, discussion for this testifier? Thank you.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chair,
Madam.
I think this might be where it would be helpful to have the director of the program come up, because I think you've hit on sort of an essential issue, Representative Ward, where somebody can be referred or refer themselves to the HPSP program without their board necessarily knowing about it. And I think that gives them some incentive to go through the treatment, to be under the monitoring, which is, as I understand it, and she can speak to it, but it allows them to be safe practicing, or in some cases to be told don't practice for a while until you stop using and whatever, and to protect the public without exposing them to that public process. But what we're talking about here is the gap where they've failed out of that program, and now what? Because, you know, people can be put in a great deal of jeopardy by some of those practitioners. So,
Welcome to the committee. If you identify yourself for the record and give your testimony.
Chair, members of the committee, I'm Monica Feiter. I'm the program manager for the Health Professional Services Program. And I'd like to reiterate what Representative Liebling said. HPSP was developed to promote early intervention, diagnosis, treatment, and monitoring for health professionals with illnesses. So prior to the program being incepted back in 1994, there was concern among health professionals to report their illnesses or seek treatment for fear of being disciplined by their boards, because the boards didn't have any other means to address illness-related issues. So they developed HPSP as an incentive for people to report their board, their illnesses to the program instead of their licensing boards. So that incentive is still there. I think the bill addresses, like Representative Liebling said, what happens when people aren't compliant with monitoring. There is a gap right now, and we're looking at ways to eliminate that gap or shorten it so that the public safety is not compromised.
Any further questions from Spider? And continue.
Did you have more you had to say?
Yeah.
Do you have any other testimony?
Yeah, I'd like to provide a little testimony. I first of all, I want to really thank Representative Liebling and her staff for their openness in looking at this bill and accepting feedback. The amendment addresses a lot of the issues that the health licensing boards have had and that I myself have had. I want to touch on a few key pieces, and one of those is with the advisory committee changing the definition of the composition of the advisory committee. Historically, or in current statute, there are a few professional associations mentioned. This leaves it open to all professional associations and doesn't delineate who can and can't participate. So I think that's very positive. I would like to see the role of the advisory committee expanded. Currently, it is to advise the program committee. I think in reality, what the advisory committee does in addition to that is advises program staff on practice settings. So we have a better understanding when someone's returning to practice, what kind of settings they're returning to. And they also serve as a key liaison between our program and their membership. For example, some folks from the Pharmacist Recovery Network will bring people to our office who are self-reporting. So they're a direct conduit to engaging people in our program. The other piece I want to commend Representative Liebling on, when I first saw the first draft of the bill, it was concerned that people being discharged from the Health Professional Services Program were being treated differently than people who were reported to their boards by other sources. And this really closes that. The same potential temporary suspension would be for people discharged from the program, but also for other reports. So I think that's a key improvement. Other improvement, I think, that I want to mention historically, in our current statute, persons with HIV, HBV, and HCV who are, and this was the question that you had, for certain professions, they're not eligible for the program unless they're referred by their licensing board. So this will enable them to be eligible for the program. The Department of Health will still monitor those illnesses, but they can have their substance disorder or psychiatric or other medical disorder monitored by the Health Professional Services Program. So I think that's a key improvement to this, to our legislation. So again, I want to thank Representative Liebling for her approach to this and willingness to accept feedback.
Well, thank you, Mr. Vaya. If you could stay, just in case there might be some questions later, appreciate it. Thank you. Any questions for our testifier? Seeing none, thank you. Julia Donnelly from Minnesota Nurses Association, if you'd welcome, and if you'll introduce yourself for the record and give our testimony.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Julia Donnelly, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Nurses Association. And we represent nearly 20,000 nurses that work in Minnesota hospitals. And again, we are here to echo our support for Representative Liebling's House File 1898. So we take the reputation of nurses very seriously, as well as patient safety. And the most recent Gallup poll shows 85% of the American public have a great deal of trust in nurses. And most of those who work in Minnesota are skilled caregivers that always put patient safety first. We believe this bill offers the necessary policies for strengthening patient safety and addressing chemical dependency as a chronic and manageable disease. It creates consistency and stability in the Health Professional Services Program by asking the executive directors of the health licensing boards to come up with uniform criteria and procedures when dealing with licensed professionals living with chemical, mental, or medical health disorders. And furthermore, we applaud this legislation's efforts to promote early intervention for health professionals living with substance use disorder while simultaneously giving the boards the authority and a mechanism to intervene when continued practice creates a risk. And to that, I just want to thank Chair Liebling for authoring this legislation. I look forward to working with all of you as this bill moves forward, and of course I can stand for any questions.
Ms. Donnelly, thank you for your testimony, and with an 85% popularity rating, you ought to do a seminar for politicians or aspiring politicians.
Well, you know, I figured lobbyists have one of the lowest, but I work for nurses, so I think I'm somewhere in the middle.
Yeah. Any questions? Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure who to ask the question to, and I apologize that I'm not really familiar with all the things that are in this Minnesota Health Licensing Board Executive Director's letter. But it does raise some questions in my mind, and I'm perhaps you can just assure me that these things are being addressed, or at least that you're in communication with people about these issues. I'm looking, for instance, at the funding mechanism that they say is not identified in the bill, and they wonder what the impact is going to be on licensing board operations because they're dependent on licensing fees. That strikes me as not really connected, but you know, since they brought up a whole array of things,
right.
I'm wondering if someone could just rebut those or explain how they're being dealt with, please.
Right.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Representative Liebling.
Representative Ward. First of all, I think that letter was on the old language that we've replaced.
Okay.
So we have worked on a lot of these. Now, this is not to say that every issue that might actually be in contention has been resolved, because you heard from the Board of Dentistry they don't like us moving the administration of this out of the Board of Dentistry. Mm-hmm. And you know, the reason that we were thinking along those lines is that we thought that giving the program some independence from the board, at the from the health boards, right, at the same time that they should certainly interact with them and be responsive to the concerns from individual boards about what members of that profession need, we thought that was good. But we thought it might be a little bit healthier, or at least a thought that we should, you know, give the program more independence. Mm-hmm. And that's certainly something that we'll continue to talk about. And actually, I'd actually like to ask Ms. Donnelly if she wouldn't mind commenting on that, whether she has a thought on that particular aspect, because, you know, I'm hearing what the boards are saying about that. It's, you know, it is what it is right now, and they don't want a change. They don't see a need for a change, but you know, maybe there might be other views on that.
Ms. Donnelly?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Chair Liebling, to your point, I think what we were thinking when we have had conversations about this was, currently the administering board can rotate. And currently it's been with the Board of Dentistry, and they seem to have done a really great job. They have a good cooperative working relationship with Ms. Feider and her staff. But that board changes, and again, every 6 and 7 years, or I guess historically, from my understanding, whenever an executive director retires. We believe very much that HPSP works. It is a voluntary alternative to discipline. We believe that it should have some, I don't want to say autonomy, because they definitely work in conjunction and collaboration with the health licensing boards. But I think when it comes to kind of the human resources functions, the hiring and firing of personnel, then maybe that might be moved best to a neutral party. Again, not to put criticism on Mr. Schrag or the Board of Dentistry, but I think if we're looking into the future, if there are structures, parallel structures within state government that already do this type of work in regards to the human resources functions, that could be a positive place to put this. And again, I think we're all looking to strengthen this program to continue its mission of both fostering an environment for early intervention of a variety of diseases, but also providing public safety. And I think that we do support that measure. But again, we're always open to discussion on this.
Representative Ward?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I very much appreciate your helping to clarify that. I think we're all talking about not only change, just changing in procedures, but to really focus on healing the healers, as well as protecting the general public and the patients in the general public. So I would just ask to be sure that we really are addressing those concerns, because I'm sure that some of those are important, and we'll end up with a better, through the conversations, we'll end up with a better product for everyone. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this, I'm not sure who might answer this, but under line, it's about the participant costs. And I have a beginning question and then kind of follow up in terms of, it's more of a curiosity in terms of the length of a rehabilitation or the services provided, what's their duration, and just curious what costs are incurred. What is the total cost for a rehabilitative program of this nature to a patient or a participant?
Representative, or Ms. Feider might be
yes.
Yep. One we'd need to have.
Yeah. Yeah. Monica Feider from HPSP again. Participants are responsible for their treatment, and of course that depends on whether or not they have insurance. If they don't have insurance, then we try to direct them to their community mental health centers if appropriate, or try to help them get some insurance. The other thing participants are responsible for, if they have a substance use disorder, they're required to provide random urine toxicology screens, and they are responsible for the cost of their screens, and those can range. Collection sites are one fee, and some employers will pay for the collection site, especially if they have an employee health program. the collections of the toxicology screens may be done at work. For other individuals, they have to pay for the collection of the screens, and that can range from $10 to as much as an emergency room copay. And then the cost of the screens range from about $20 to $60. On average, people receive or are required to provide 9 screens per quarter or 3 screens per month. And so if you average a $20 collection fee and, let's say, a $30 toxicology test, that would be $50 times 3, so $150 a month just for the toxicology screens. When people aren't working, we try to adjust the frequency of screens. One of the other pieces that we do to try to reduce the cost of screens is to look at what the individual's drug of choice is and to try to tailor some of the panels that they're tested for to just those drugs to decrease the cost of screens.
And Mr. Chair.
Representative Liebling.
You, and Mr. Chair, I think it's good probably at this point to just to clarify that HPSB doesn't provide treatment. It's really a monitoring program, so they'll design a program for somebody and they'll say you have to do X, Y, and Z, and then they're going to make sure the person's doing it, but they're not actually providing the services.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Albright?
I have nothing further.
Any further questions?
Mr. Chair, I have another testifier
Very
here.
Good. Welcome, and if you identify yourself for the record, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dr. Cody Weiberg. I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Pharmacy. Just really wanted to come up here and address Representative Ward's question. Since the executive directors did send out this letter on March 4th, basically when we saw the original draft of the bill, and Representative Liebling is correct, we had concerns about the original version of the bill. Those are the concerns that are expressed here. Looking at the DE2 amendment, I think that almost all of those concerns have been addressed. Even a portion of the governance is addressed. For example, the portion here that sort of streamlines the program committee, I know that I think my board's going to like, and my board actually has a public meeting tomorrow morning, and I'll be discussing this. You know, we still, as Representative Liebling has mentioned, we might have some discussions about whether admin's the appropriate place to do some of this. That's still one remaining issue. But the language around temporary license suspensions, the program funding, all of that, all of those have been resolved. And so, and the reason I'm up here instead of Mr. Schrag is the executive directors meet once a month, first Tuesday of the month. When this issue came up, I was kind of sort of designated as someone other than the executive director for the managing board to come over and talk about this issue. And so I think this really, this DE2 amendment actually addresses almost all the concerns the board's had. Great.
Yeah, thank you. Any further questions for either Dr. Weiborg or any of the other testifiers?
Yeah.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to tell the committee as well that this issue about the automatic suspension that was in the prior draft, that's something that's also in the Senate's bill, as I understand, and something that the governor has been interested in, because we've all been interested in this gap issue, and they went first with their bill stand, and something that the governor has been interested in, because we've all been interested in this gap issue, and they went first with their bill and I think passed their bill with that in it. And so this will have to be discussion and conference. But we think that having worked this through a little bit, that we've really come to understand that our way of dealing with it is better, because if you look at the various licensed professionals, they're not all in the same situation in terms of their ability to do harm to a patient or in their how much they come into contact with potential drugs of abuse, for example. So, somebody who's an occupational therapist, just to pick it out of my head, you know, might not be around drugs of abuse so much, or could be monitored, or could be kept away from their drug of abuse, whereas, you know, somebody in another profession might be in more constant contact with it. And so it didn't make sense to us when we thought about this and listened to the boards to have sort of a one-size-fits-all. That's why we structured it this way. And so I think there will be continuing discussion as we move the bill forward and discuss it with the Senate as well.
Any further discussion? See none. Is there anyone in the audience who would like to come forward and testify? Seeing none, Representative Liebling, would you like to make a concluding statement before we vote?
Well, just thank you for your attention, members, and, you know, very happy to have the input we've had today. And as you see, these issues can be pretty complicated. And, you know, if anybody has further wants to have further input, I'm very happy to work with you. And also, I want to really thank our committee administrator, because he really did the lion's share of the work on this amendment and has been very instrumental in helping to bring the parties together. So, okay, so with that, Mr. Chair, I would renew my motion that House File 1898, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on State Government Finance.
All right. All those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed? Very good.
Thank you.
Bumbled through.
I just didn't want you to vote no on that one amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I wrote down a couple notes.
Not a problem. All right, Representative Loeffler, House File 1867.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to recommend that or move that House File 1867 be
Referred to the Committee on Government Operations, I bet.
That's right.
That's the one?
I always have to think a little bit. I'm pausing because we sometimes change names.
Okay. And then you have an author's amendment.
And I have a couple of author's amendments.
Okay.
And these, and both of them, the A1 and the A2 amendment, just take groups that are proposed to be expiring in current law in 2014 and extend them till 2018. And these were all groups that were recommended by the agencies that they provide advice to continue.
Okay, so Representative Loeffler moves the, we'll just do them one at a time, Representative Loeffler.
Mm-hmm.
She moves the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape that she would like it. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, no. Motion prevails. And now Representative Loeffler moves the A2 to get the bill in even better shape. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Motion prevails.
Okay. Thank you, members. The bill before you represents the recommendations of the Legislative Commission on Planning and Fiscal Policy, which usually deals with big economic issues, but is also chartered in and directed in statute to regularly review the advisory committees to the executive branch. And so this summer, the head of the commission, Speaker Thiessen, sent out a letter to all of the 162 advisory committees existing in statute and asked them to complete a questionnaire about their mission, their three most recent meetings, what recommendations have they provided, who their membership is. And we had a process in which we had a series of four long hearings going through these. We had a bipartisan House and Senate subcommittee that spent even more time looking at the actual function and responses of these groups. And the recommendation, the bill before you reflects the recommendations of that process, which took public hearing and testimony, to repeal some groups that have not been as active. You know, sometimes we'll create advisory groups because we really want the initial design of a program to be bear the input of those who are affected by it. But then once the program's up and running, there's less and less for them to review and advise on sometimes, and the sometimes feels like it's a burden to have this advisory committee have to go through the whole appointment process. Sometimes it's hard to recruit people to serve in these positions because it really isn't an active ongoing force. And so it's good for us to periodically review these groups and decide which ones really are continuing to be vital and important in terms of bringing the voice of stakeholders and others to our policymaking and that of the executive agencies. And you know, it's a long list. If the committee would like me to go through all the various ones, I can. I can tell you that since the since that time, which was this summer and fall, and since the bill was been introduced, I have not heard one person, agency, individual, or anyone else who's involved in this process object to any of these recommended changes. And so I think that says that the process that was used this summer and fall was quite fair, and that those that were impacted had a chance to be heard and influence the recommendations.
All right. Thank you, Representative Loeffler. I must say I see in here one of the best section titles I've seen. Clarification of continued existence. Okay. Are there questions from members? Does anybody feel like they need a walkthrough of this bill? No. Okay. No. All right. Are there testifiers?
None that I have brought.
None. Okay. Does anybody present want to testify for or against the bill? Not seeing any takers. So with that, Representative Loeffler renews her motion that House File 1867 as amended be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, no. Motion prevails. And I believe we have completed our agenda, and we are adjourned. Thank you.